On this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Diane Powell on the ESP Enigma.
If you're waiting for the paradigm shift, if you're waiting for science to roll over and say, "Uncle, we admit it, there's this phenomenon is obvious, it's self-evident," it's not going to happen.
I agree. And I think that, as I said, it is counterproductive to think that way. People close their mind to considering, you know, new possibilities. I mean, like I said, when people thought that all of the physics had been discovered, there was this whole other world out there. And I believe that's true for consciousness.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode of Skeptico, Dr. Diane Powell talks about her interesting and unique approach to studying parapsychology and some of the issues that extend beyond parapsychology. Some of those issues we were not able to get into in this interview, or actually we got into them, and then Diane said, "Wait, I don't really want to go there yet." But hopefully she'll come back and explore that. If you look at her bio and her background, you might have an idea of what I'm talking about. Still, what we did talk about, I think, is very interesting. Here's my dialogue with Dr. Diane Powell. Today, we welcome Dr. Diane Powell to Skeptico. Diane has an amazing background, stellar credentials, Johns Hopkins trained neuroscientist, MD in psychiatry from Johns Hopkins as well, faculty position at Harvard Medical School, Salk Institute, right here in my backyard of La Jolla. I mean, the credentials go on and on. She's also written a book titled The ESP Enigma. Dr. Powell, thank you for joining me so much, and welcome to Skeptico.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, I had a chance the other day to take a look at your excellent website at DianeHennesseyPowell.com, and I was really amazed. So many of the topics you cover are right up our alley here at Skeptico, so I'm really looking forward to this dialogue. I mean, you teed up so many questions, that more questions that I could possibly get to, so I hardly know where to begin.
I want to get people to think. That's my mission.
Great. You know, that I guess was one of my first questions, because you do have such a really stellar background. And I had to wonder while I was reading this, you know, gee, Diane, why can't you just play nice with the other neuroscientists? Why do you have to go off and do this ESP thing and basically claim that the emperor has no clothes like you do? Hasn't that been a rather difficult path for you to follow?
It has been a difficult path. And unfortunately, it's not a path that's embraced by academia. And I'm somebody who grew up with academia in my blood. My father was a professor. He started out as a geneticist and ended up as a cardiovascular physiologist working on he was the head of the artificial heart program at Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. And so I grew up in a scientific family. One of my brothers is a theoretical physicist whose expertise is artificial intelligence. And so I have a very, very interesting family. And I'm used to getting together and talking about questions and being interested in the truth, like a detective. That's how I grew up. And when I started to see holes in this model of that neuroscientists had, I started to think, okay, well, you know, how can we explain those holes? How can we explain those mysteries? And what I found was that there were so many things that were not explained, and yet people were hanging on to that model. And in fact, you know, continuing to pour lots of research dollars into continuing to find yet another neurotransmitter and another receptor for those neurotransmitters. And I was thinking to myself, this isn't answering the questions that I'm interested in.
Let me interject here. Do you recall what were some of the first instances of that you bumped into that you really thought, wow, this is interesting, and then you followed it up and found that there weren't good answers coming back?
Yes. I mean, the first one that I had happened actually when I was a teenager, and a friend of mine was someone who traveled in the circus during the summer. And he invited me over to his house because the magician that he traveled with was there, and he had talked so highly about him that he said, you know, of course, you know, we'd love to have you come over and meet him. And his name was Jay Michelle, and he did Houdini-like tricks. But when I met him, he wanted to show me some other things that he could do. And what he did was he had me stand across the room from him, which was about maybe 15 feet, and there was a bookshelf behind me with probably 1,000 books. And he said, pick any book out, open it up to any page, and as you're reading it, I'll read it to you. And he did that. And he was able to do that for several books and several pages. And it blew my mind. And when I asked him about it, he said, he said, well, that's just, you know, a magic trick. It's just magic. But it didn't, you know, I said, okay, I guess it's just magic. And I asked my father about it, and he said, well, there is this controversial topic, a study called telepathy, and that's what it sounds like to me. And so he didn't poo-poo the whole possibility of it, but he let me know that it was controversial. But I just didn't have anything for another 15 years before I had my next experience. And that was when I was on faculty at Harvard, and I was asked to evaluate a woman who had been admitted to the emergency room because she had complaints that were consistent with a heart attack. And back then, you had to wait at least 24 hours or so to get blood tests back to tell you if somebody had released the enzymes from, you know, your heart that you would see if somebody had a damaged heart from a heart attack. And this woman wanted to leave right after she was admitted upstairs to the hospital from the emergency room. And so I was asked to go see her because I was the director of the service that did that, that went to the wards where medical wards or surgical wards where patients were in case there was a problem. And somebody can't leave a hospital against medical advice if they're deemed to be insane. And this woman was thought by the staff there to be insane. So I walked in to evaluate her, and she after, you know, we talked for just a few minutes, she just all of a sudden looked at me, and she said, she said, I'm a psychic, and I know the tests are going to come back normal, so can I go home? This place is full of ghosts, and it's really not comfortable for me to stay here.
Well, those are some good signs, right, for a psychiatrist, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, most psychiatrists would have just, at that point, said, you know, really nice to meet you. And because I wasn't being paid by the hour or anything, they just wanted me to, you know, determine if she's sane or not. And most psychiatrists would have just walked out the door and signed the paperwork and forced her to stay. But I like to talk to people, and she intrigued me. And so I sat down to talk with her a little more. And when she saw that I was willing to do that, she, after a few minutes, she looked at me and she said, I'm getting a reading on you. Do you mind if I just tell you what I'm seeing? And she started to tell me things about my current life and my past that were extremely precise. She told me that at the time, my husband was applying for a postdoctorate in biochemistry, and he was applying for one back at Johns Hopkins, and he was also applying for one at UCSD. And she said to me, one of the things she said to me was, she said, you're married to someone who's a chemist, and he's applying for a job in two different cities right now. Now, that's pretty specific.
Right.
Yeah, it caught my attention. And so I said, well, if that were true, which cities are we talking about? And she said, well, in his heart of hearts, he wants to go to one city, but you're going to end up going to the other city. And I knew that in his heart of hearts, he really wanted to go back to Johns Hopkins. I mean, that was where he was born. That was where his family was. I mean, that's, we had a lot of friends back there. And, you know, California is like the, you know, kind of like the frontiers to people who are from the East Coast sometimes.
Right.
And so I knew in his heart of hearts, he really wanted to go back to Johns Hopkins. But she said we'd go up to the other one. And so I said, well, let me name some cities. And so I named off several cities, and she said, San Diego, that's where you'll go. And guess what? That's where we ended up.
How do you process that? I mean, how do you process that being a professional, having this background? Where do you go with that kind of stuff?
Well, exactly. I mean, the problem is that the model that I was trained in psychiatry was that if someone claims to be able to read minds or have psychic abilities like that, that it's a sign that they're either a scam artist or they're delusional, and that means, you know, that they're insane. And so there isn't a framework for that in the model that I was raised with. And so that's why I started to look to see, is there really well-conducted research on this topic? I mean, if this is a real phenomena, then let me see what the research looks like. And I found that there are lots of studies that have been conducted meticulously, and they really suggest that this phenomena is real.
And that leads to your book, I guess, the ESP Enigma, which explores this topic that's commonly referred to as ESP. But you kind of go further and look at it really combining your neuroscience background as what might be some of the neurological markers for these abilities that people have. Is that right? Tell us a little bit about the book.
Yeah, well, sure. And first of all, before I say anything about the book, I just want to make a comment here, and that is that since writing the book, because the book actually came out, that it actually came out 4 years ago tomorrow, so it's my book's birthday. when I wrote the book, my publisher really wanted me to use the word ESP in the title because she felt that the public would know what that was, and looking back on it, I realized that when I run into some difficulties with people looking at my work, it's because of the fact that I use the word ESP or use the word psychic. You know, I feel like the field would probably move forward better if we just said that which shall not be named.
What do you mean by that exactly? I mean, what name would we put on it? Because we have psi, we have parapsychology, we have remote viewing. We have all these terms floating around out there, and one doesn't seem to serve us any better than the rest in terms of penetrating the kind of blockade that mainstream materialistic science has put up.
But that's right. I mean, as you know, what has happened is people in the field have recognized that, and so they have tried to come up with names that sound more scientific, like psi and remote viewing. And the problem is that, and that's why I say it really should be called that which shall not be named, because it really puts it in their face almost. And I'm talking about, of course, not an academic, but I mean, really, it puts it out there as the problem is really in labeling it something. To me, if you just say this is an interesting phenomenon, what was that? Let's do experiments on that. I think that some people might be more receptive to it. Does that make sense to you?
Maybe, but you know, one of the things I was hoping to explore today, and we might kind of just jump ahead, and then we can backfill anything we want to. Is I was really intrigued by this one question answer that you provide on your website, and the question you pose is, do you believe science will ever develop so that we can finally fully understand human consciousness? Which I think is related to this question of these extra human capabilities that are part of consciousness that pop up all the time, that you can just search your own family history and find a dozen accounts of it. But anyways, your response is, no, I believe we will have a much fuller understanding, but it would be unrealistic to ever think that that goal is attainable and counterproductive to believe that it has been achieved. We know this from history. Scientists believe that they had a full comprehension of physics before Einstein. Process that for a little bit. What I like is the first word, no, because I feel like I've come to the same conclusion and often share that with folks on this show. If you're waiting for the paradigm shift, if you're waiting for science to roll over and say, "Uncle, we admit it. There's this phenomenon is obvious. It's self-evident." It's not going to happen.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think that, as I said, it is counterproductive to think that way. And I think that people close their minds to considering, you know, new possibilities. I mean, like I said, when people thought that all of the physics had been discovered, there was this whole other world out there. And I believe that's true for consciousness. And I think that we're just now starting to have more and more receptivity to studying that. But still trying to understand, I think human consciousness is just too vast of a topic. And you're not going to be able to understand it through science, which is so analytical in its approach. I mean, that's only one tool in trying to obtain knowledge.
Isn't there also a problem, maybe, Diane, in that when we think of a post-materialistic science, there really isn't any science anymore? How do we measure anymore? You know, my wife is a psychologist, and I often have these discussions with her, you know, and she does forensic work and down at the prison and in the court system and stuff like that. And it's like, once you introduce this X factor, which is what we're talking about with these extended human capabilities of consciousness, don't we have to re-question everything? Don't we have to put an asterisk on every psychological exam? Don't we have to go back through the records and the DSM-4 and everything else, or the story that you told about the patient that you were admitting and doing an assessment of? Doesn't everything change once we move past this idea that consciousness may be fundamental to who we are?
Yes and no, because we're still taught. Let's use physics as an example. We're still taught Newtonian physics because it has its place. It helps us construct our houses, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, the modern physics helps us to really understand more about the essence of the, of matter, for example. You know, this table that I'm near, is actually not solid. It appears that way to me. So it helps me to understand, and physicists use that information to create things like, our iPods, that knowledge of that which isn't seen, but which was theory at one time. And so it's one of those things where we have both of those types of physics apply. And I think that similarly, as we expand our understanding of consciousness, there's still going to be a place for, what neurologists do, for example. So some things change and some things don't. I think what changes are the kinds of questions that people pose. What changes a lot is what people think is possible. But people still are having to interact with, this material. Our brains are wired for us to interact with this material world. So we can be, we can be someplace different in our thinking, but still be living in this other world. I mean, does that answer your question?
Well, maybe. I think I have to push you a little bit further by bringing you back to another question from your website, and that's your understanding of what happens to consciousness after our physical death. What do you think that the best data suggests?
I'm really interested in near-death experience research, and I think that it is very, very compelling.
Right. None of those are simple explanations because, as you say, they all kind of defy our current understanding of how that might work. But if we take the most straightforward one that near-death experiencers report is really happening, and that is that their consciousness does leave their body and goes to this other place, then I think, aren't we compelled to kind of dig into the content of what they're saying and actually tackle the near-death experience that comes back and starts looking very spiritual? I mean, how do we then incorporate that whole thing in and handle the spiritual aspect of this, the religious implications and social implications of truly having a life that goes on beyond our death, truly having other lives. Of course, the work of Ian Stevenson at the University of Virginia that has now been picked up by other folks like Jim Tucker at the University of Virginia strongly suggests that not only that consciousness survives death, but that consciousness continues on in future lives. Don't we have a lot to really swallow there when we accept this near-death experience science?
Oh, we sure do. We sure. And it's that's the kind of thing that drew me like a magnet to wanting to study this field. I mean, it to me is very compelling, all of that research that you mentioned. And there's other research that's suggestive. I think that that of the non-material view of the brain, besides that, and so it all actually, see, the thing is that it all kind of fits into a puzzle that, and that's why I wrote the book that I wrote. It all really fits into a puzzle. It's just that people within mainstream science don't want to step back and look at that whole puzzle. They've been wanting to just, focus in, in a more reductionist way.
What do you think that puzzle is looking like? How is it emerging?
Well, that's where I think that one of the things that I like to do is I had to study a lot of different fields in order to become a doctor. And I was in neuroscience, I was in biophysics, so I know a lot about biology and physics and different disciplines. And I really see where physics holds a lot of answers to us. I think the answers to our understanding of consciousness really are at that level. And I firmly believe that there's nothing woo-woo about these experiences that I'm talking about, that it's that they're not defying natural laws. They're just defying natural laws as science has so far defined them in their limited way. And so when we look at physics, we see that there's a lot of, and I'm sure you're aware of all of the literature written by physicists showing the commonality between their way of looking at the subatomic world and the way that meditating monks describe the experiences that they have when they're meditating. This sense that everything is interconnected and this sense of timelessness. And I mean, it's in physics, time, the idea of time being arrow, that is how our brain is really wired to perceive it. But in physics, there's an acceptance that, that time can be, symmetrical, that there isn't really a need for time to be just a direction, that dimension that only goes in one direction. All the other dimensions are symmetrical.
I guess I hear you on all that. What I always struggle with, though, and just lately I've come back around to appreciating in a strange way the material, scientific materialism in a way, in that I don't know what we can really do with that. What can we really do with the idea that time may be symmetrical, that we're all connected, unless you want to jump into the God proposition?
Well, what I'm doing is, I think it's appropriate for me to talk about my work because what I'm trying to do is approach these questions in a way that's very different from how they've been approached by other people, because what I see is that there's a lot of people that are they just seem to be going around in circles in terms of because of the very nature of what you just said. These questions, they just seem to be so just so large and so vast. I mean, how could we ever get to answering them? And so I'm somebody who thinks strategically and thinks, okay, where do we start? How can we just lay down the first, you know, paver for this. And what I've thought about is that science has accepted the fact that autistic savants can do the things that they do. They don't dispute that.
Specifically, what are some examples of that?
For example, there are people like Leslie Lemke, who was able to sit down and play a Mozart concerto without ever having had a piano lesson, having heard it and just sit down and play it. And there are lots of musical savants like that. And, you know, I can look at that and I can say, okay, that's impressive, but maybe he just has an extraordinary ear for music and extraordinary memory. So that could just be an extreme gift. And that doesn't have the same wow factor, but it still is pretty impressive. So there are savants like that. The savants that really fascinate me are the savants who have knowledge that they have no way of knowing. They have not been exposed to it. You know, so for example, Daryl Trefort examined this autistic savant, and here it is, a child hasn't gone to school, because they frequently can't go to school, they can't function, they oftentimes can't even add, and yet they can do these extraordinary things, such as this child. And what this child did was Daryl Trefort just saw it off at the top of his head. He thought, well, man, what could I ask this child to do, you know, that could show that he has access to information that he hasn't been exposed to? He asked him to draw the periodic table, and he did. Hmm. And he drew it with it was accurate, and he even drew in the letters that are used for the different elements. And the letters, of course, are for the Latin word for the elements, you know, and so, and then, you know, and the atomic numbers, atomic weights, you know, so that's a lot of information for a child to just produce. And so where does that come from? Where does that come from? And the fact that these children they're not, you know, hanging a shingle, saying that they're a psychic, and you know, they're not interested in that sort of thing. This information is just information that comes to them. So that there isn't this secondary gain that people oftentimes have questions about for someone. They think, oh well, it must be a parlor trick, or they're those kinds of questions people raise. With the autistic savants, there isn't that. So scientists accept that there are these people that can do things like that. Another example is Oliver Sacks' twins, who could, they could toss back and forth prime numbers, and prime numbers that were in, you know, 6-7 digits. And we don't really even have an algorithm for prime numbers. I mean, a prime number is a number that can't be divided by anything other than itself and one. And so to be able to just come up with what would be the next prime number in sequence, just, within, seconds, is extraordinary. And where is that coming from?
Sure. I mean, that's a fair question, and it's a fascinating experiment. But does it penetrate? You know, you mentioned Oliver Sacks, and it's interesting to me because his name just popped up recently, at least to me again, because I had done an interview with Dr. Eben Alexander, the neurosurgeon from Harvard, who published, which is right now as we speak, the New York Times number one bestseller, Proof of Heaven. Mm-hmm. And he had this extraordinary near-death experience, and as a neurosurgeon and a neuroscientist was able to say, there isn't a good medical explanation for this. And Oliver Sacks is one of the many on the kind of old guard neuroscience crowd who jumped up and said, wait, this guy should have never said this. This is impossible. We know categorically that all conscious experience is generated by the brain, and this is therefore impossible. So what will your work
with savants, how will that really change this? It's back to the question that I asked you early on. You know, is there going to be this paradigm shift? Is there going to be this awareness or this acknowledgement by science that, hey, the game is up for materialism? No, that's not going to happen.
Well. Let me walk you through the logic here, because so one of the problems you have with the near death experience is, And you know, one of the reasons why I didn't choose them is because, I mean, they're fascinating, and they're absolutely fascinating to me. And the problem is that a lot of neurologists view that as a hallucinatory experience. And you know, Oliver Sacks, I just recently read a New Yorker article with him in which he was talking about how much LSD he took during his neurology residency. Which was a bit of a it was an interesting article to me. But, you know, he's very much someone who, you know, thinks, you know, has that view of things as being, you know, hallucinations, you know. And so how am I approaching it differently? Okay, so you have this phenomenon. You have autistic savants who can do things like produce prime numbers, you know, just sequentially. What I'm doing is I'm setting up experiments that I'm going to be using with the autistic savants to see if they can do these things. And if they can do these things, then they, I think that people will look at the phenomena, you know, in a different light. I asked someone, what do you think would be, you know, a really good experiment to do? And he said, well, coding is, spy coding is oftentimes created by taking two large prime numbers and multiplying them against one another and then coming up with a number. And so you have this massive number, and you have to know what the two primes were that were multiplied together to create that number. And he said, so if they could take that number and figure out what the two primes are that created it, and we're talking about, you know, a 12-digit number, he said that the amount of computer, he knows how much computer effort that takes to do that for espionage purposes. So he said, if they can do that, then we really need to think differently about, you know, about the brain. And so those are the kinds of experiments that I'm going to be doing, seeing if there's something that is going to cause people to go, wow, and it's reproducible. See, that's been the major problem that, you know, this kind of research has had so far, is that people say it's not reproducible. You know, psychics aren't 100% accurate. Well, these savants are 100% accurate when you tap into the ability they have.
What do you think? What's your hunch about the relationship that this suggests between the brain, the physical brain, and consciousness? You must have an idea that maybe you don't always share, but share it now to us. What do you think's going on?
The best that I can come up with is based upon the idea that we live in a holographic universe, and that embedded in a multidimensional universe. So you have all of these hidden dimensions, and you also have like non-locality, okay, which I think is really just a product of the fact that we live in a multidimensional universe. In other words, if you have all of these dimensions that all are invisible to us, but they are, let me put it this way, where I am in the future, okay, that's me at a different place in time, okay, the dimensions we know, but it may be that the other dimensions, you know, another, you know, 6-7 dimensions may be all the same. And so that may be why we're able to access things. We may be traveling along different dimensions. But I also think that we live in a holographic universe, and that in every point in space-time that we can have a representation of all of space-time, that all of the information is embedded in it, right in space-time itself. And that when people have psychic experiences, that they're actually tapping into information because of just the way the universe is constructed. And our consciousness field is actually, you know, holographically organized so that people can, you know, just like our brains, you know, they can access information. You know, there's a place in our brains where we have memories encoded. And, you know, similarly, I think that, you know, in our consciousness field, there are, you know, there's ways that people, you know, can access information from it selectively.
Okay, so we have a holographic universe, a holographic consciousness field. Is there an order? Is there a hierarchy to consciousness? Many of these experiencers of all different sorts, near-death experiencers, out-of-body experiencers, psychics, mediums, report that there is a hierarchy. And what we're really, that's a nice, polite way of talking, a politically correct way of talking about God, because when we start talking about a hierarchical order, we eventually have to reach the top of that pyramid, and it comes down to something that in some way matches what people talk about God. Mm-hmm. Is that suggested in the data?
I believe that there is a higher order. I believe that, you know, the and chaos, you know, theory suggests that, you know, that there is far more order to the universe than we ever anticipated. And I think the problem is that, you know, God has all of these connotations attached to, because there's the, you know, this idea of this man in the sky with, you know, gray hair and a gray beard. And there's, you know, just all of the, you know, rich, you know, theologies that are out there that I think are, to me, a lot of them are different cultures' best attempt to really try to ascribe, you know, describe the ineffable. And then, of course, you know, religions are, you know, oftentimes, you know, they become corrupted by, you know, the people who, you know, that are in charge. But it's still, I think the major problem is using the word God. I think that sense of higher order, it is a sense of awe and spirituality, you know, and our brains seem to be wired to actually appreciate that.
Fantastic. Well, you're very, very brave to do it. I mean, there's no two ways about it. There are so many folks that we've interviewed that are not willing to go there, are only willing to tiptoe around it, and for you to kind of jump right in and not be afraid to tackle any of these subjects, as well as bring that kind of interdisciplinary approach, I think is really to be commended. And someone in the background is agreeing with me there.
Yes. My dogs, they're agreeing with you as psychically, I think.
Great. Well, Dr. Paul, it's been a great pleasure getting to know you and talking with you. Tell us a little bit in the few minutes we have left about what's going on with your research. You mentioned your work with savants. Are there new books coming out? Are you having any speaking engagements planned, anything like that?
I'm going to be leaving for India, actually, in a week, and evaluating three autistic savant children over there who they're supposedly psychic, that they supposedly have precognitive abilities. I'm going to be testing that out, seeing if that's the case. And then I'll be speaking about autism and the autistic savant syndrome and ESP while I'm there, doing some workshops and lectures. And that's where I'm going to be in January. And then I'll come back and I'll be announcing on my website new radio interviews and other appearances.
Great. Well, best of luck with all that work, and we'll sure follow everything that you're doing and try and make other people aware of it, because it's a really important work, and we wish you the best of luck with it.
Well, thank you.
Thanks again to Dr. Powell for joining me today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information about this show or any of our previous shows, please visit the Skeptico website. It's at S-K-E-P-T-I-K-O. There you'll find links to all our previous shows, a link to our forum, comment section, and a bunch of other good stuff. Have a couple of really good shows coming up. Please stay with me for all of that. But until next time, take care. Bye for now.